Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the millions of leaked documents dubbed the Paradise Papers bring some sunlight to an arena where secrecy is the whole point. The world of offshore financial centers, where a melange of the world's wealthiest stash money, bilk governments, and generally betray any notion of a social compact. It's great reporting. It involves trillions of dollars. Now what? We'll speak with investigative economist and author James Henry. Also on the show, after a man killed 26 people and wounded 20 more in a Texas church, and his demographic details signaled media would be going the troubled individual route, some have lifted up the relationship between mass killings and domestic violence, of which the Texas killer, like many before him, had a history. We talked about those connections after another mass shooting last year in Orlando, Florida, with writer and activist Soraya Chamali. We'll hear some of that conversation today. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. In September, the Los Angeles Times ran a two-part series on the tax and other benefits the Disney Corporation managed to extract in Anaheim, California, and on their efforts to influence city council elections. In a particularly ham-fisted move, Disney, though they didn't call for any actual corrections, barred LA Times reporters from advance press screenings for its movies in retaliation. Journalists took umbrage. The Washington Post's Alyssa Rosenberg said she would boycott screenings until Disney backed down. The New York Times agreed, issuing a statement saying, "A powerful company punishing a news organization for a story they do not like is a dangerous precedent and not at all in the public interest." The National Society of Film Critics and others disqualified Disney from awards. This week, citing productive discussions with LA Times leadership, Disney rescinded the ban. Journalistic solidarity, claimed The Washington Post's Eric Wemple, served notice to Disney and, quote, all prospective bullies. We media types sometimes do live up to the glorious principles that we mouth at panel discussions, close quote. It was indeed commendable action. So, maybe now they've got this solidarity thing going with the glorious principles and the concern about the powerful punishing people for stories they don't like, corporate media could stretch the idea enough to see where solidarity is needed on issues perhaps even more pressing than whether you got your Thor Ragnarok review before opening night or a day after. Ramsey Orta filmed New York police choking his friend Eric Garner to death on a Staten Island sidewalk in 2014. Since then, Orta and others believe he has been targeted by police, raiding his home and arresting him on questionable drug charges and then for obstructing governmental administration when he filmed another arrest. As activist writer Josmar Trujillo reminds at fair.org, after Orta took a plea in 2015, an unnamed NYPD source told the New York Daily News, "He took the video," alluding to the Garner tape, "now we took the video," referring to surveillance footage police claim showed Orta selling drugs. Ramsey Orta has no formal training or press credentials. He's from the streets of New York, and he's had constant contact with the criminal justice system. Just the qualities, Trujillo notes, that can make it easier to connect to people on the ground, particularly in communities of color, where there's often suspicion and resentment towards reporters, and the qualities that make citizen journalists like Orta uniquely effective in creating media for those usually left out. The failure of mainstream journalists to support or acknowledge Orta points to the need to challenge some imaginary lines. What the LA Times was doing with its Anaheim story and what Orta was doing with the Garner video are the same activity. Getting information to the public that's meaningful, not least because it's information powerful forces don't want the public to see. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. A Establishment media cover poverty sometimes, sometimes in a compassionate and compelling way. And they cover wealth and the rich sometimes, sometimes in a thoughtful and critical way. When the discussion called for is about the relationship between the two, the limits of media's spotlight approach are salient. Such a case may be presented by the Paradise Papers, a trove of some 13 million documents leaked to German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung and then shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that describes various tax hiding and avoidance schemes used by politicians and celebrities along with corporations. Stories like the New York Times' Paradise Papers shine light on where the elite keep their money, make it all seem pretty dog bites man. We read cases like that of Twitter investor Yuri Milner, who used money from a Russian state-controlled bank, or the hedge funder who hid money somehow in Bermuda. But without serious interrogation of the impacts, it comes off a bit like profiles of people who are richer than you and also smarter, especially as so much coverage seems to pivot on the fact that these activities are not illegal. So what's the next step on disclosures like these? How do we move them from journalistic feat to drivers of real change? And what sorts of changes do they suggest are necessary? Joining us now to discuss the Paradise Papers is investigative economist James Henry. He's a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Investment, and a contributor to the 2016 book Global Tax Fairness. Welcome back to Counterspin, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, we can't cover them all naturally, but what are some of the sorts of mechanisms or maneuvers that are revealed in these documents that mainly come from this place, Appleby, a Bermuda law firm that specializes in offshore funding?
The big picture, I think, takeaways from this is that we have a global haven industry that consists of a whole lot of enablers like Appleby and other law firms mentioned in this include U.S. law firms like Baker McKenzie, the big accounting firm KPMG. You know, we've seen this pattern over and over again. But basically, the one story here is that this industry is now expanded to the point where at least $30 trillion of private offshore wealth, maybe $3 trillion of corporate wealth is offshore beyond the reach of tax authorities. So, you know, that's about 12% of total world financial wealth. And if you went back 30 years when I started writing about this in the 80s, they were talking about 15 havens. Now there's more than 90 offshore. The Paradise Papers are kind of the latest installment. A lot of the journalists writing on this are, you know, under the age of 35 and are writing about it for the first time. But I'm just impressed with how long we've known about it and how little we have done effectively to clean it up.
Well, and when you start to talk about the amounts involved, it kind of moves us directly on to the impact. I mean, one can imagine, of course, that this is what could be the impact of that amount of money if it actually had, was actually taxed and actually could contribute to the public coffers in the way it was intended.
We have a big problem, not so much with tax dodging, but with kleptocracy. This is a problem of public officials helping themselves to the public wealth and moving it offshore to these havens, financial secrecy jurisdictions, where they can hide it beyond the reach of the home country. So we saw in this Paradise Papers, I worked on a project involving Angola, where the son of the dictator was basically using the sovereign wealth fund as a kind of ATM, $5 billion moving offshore to havens like Mauritius, which is an African tax haven, you know, with the help of U.S. banks and KPMG and Swiss tax advisors. So you have to imagine the global haven industry as not just about tax havens. I mean, there's a kind of a Star Wars bar scene of clients here. You have the kleptocrats, you have the giant multinationals like Apple, Nike, both of them were mentioned in the Paradise Papers here as moving assets offshore beyond the reach of tax authorities, paying themselves royalties tax-free. You know, then you have mobsters, and then you have the royals. We saw the Queen and Prince Charles mentioned in these papers. Bono, the rock star who likes to worry about development issues, in this case, turns out he's been pretty aggressive use of tax havens to shelter his own income. So, you know, there's all kinds of people who have their snouts in the trough here. And the basic thing they're sharing is this access to financial secrecy, which, you know, without these leaks, we wouldn't know all this stuff. And, you know, I think that that's the problem that the world really fails to address, because this industry is probably one of the most influential on the planet in terms of lobbying, political contributions. So it's not so much that we lack the technical ideas to clean up the industry, but we have lacked the political will. I think one thing that, comes out of this that I think is really important is to, it sort of lays the foundations for a different system of taxation to get at this stuff. And I have proposed, Jeffrey Sachs has proposed a global wealth tax, which really goes at the top class in the world, and 1-2% per year tax on wealth, especially anonymous wealth. Most of this stuff, we don't know where it is. If you just withheld against it, you don't really have to know who owns it.
Right.
But we're facing a situation where, in order to, say, realize the development goals that we've established, the world's poorest economies by the year 2030, we need about $80 billion a year. And this kind of revelation just justifies the imposition of a cross-country wealth tax on billionaires and high net worth individuals with assets more than $30 million. And, you know, you could easily raise the money that we need.
Well, and let me just say, that is leapfrogging the response that you're talking about. It leapfrogs this whole question of legality, which it seems like a lot of reporters are getting almost hung up on. You know, it, first of all, secrecy begs the question of legality. You don't know what's going on. You know, you can't even talk about what's following the law. And then you have made the point that, you know, places are invested in this business model. And so, you know, the sanctions may not exist, but that's also part of the problem.
The legality defense of this activity is really the standard defense you hear from the havens every time this comes up. And it's such a red herring. I mean, the point is, first of all, in a lot of countries like, let's say, Angola, these activities aren't illegal because they control the show. Secondly, in the first world countries like the United States and the UK and Switzerland, where a lot of this money ends up ultimately, they have devised very complicated legal structures. And so the question of what is legal is really a whole process involving lots of interpretations and laws. Even if you knew what these people were up to, it would be hard to pronounce. The way it works in an accounting firm like KPMG is they say, you know, what's legal? We define it as tax structure that has a 50% chance of surviving an audit. So it comes down to a kind of probability distribution. There is no bright line between legal and illegal, but that's just a standard kind of response. The real point is this stuff should be illegal. You know, whether it is or not is, you know, a question for thousands of lawyers.
Well, let me just take you back to the big picture for a moment, because I find myself, you know, my frustration in reading some of the coverage comes from the other media that I know exists out there, you know, the media climate, which propagates this view that basically poor people take from the state, you know, and rich people don't rely on the state, and therefore owe nothing to it. You know, I mean, there's an ideological kind of problem here that these bombshells don't seem to break through.
Well, that's right. I mean, the problem really is a political one where we have to educate people about what's going on. I mean, you know, many of the largest fortunes on the planet derive from state activity or have benefited from it in many, many ways. These people have enormous amounts of, I guess, representation without taxation. So they really want to control the political system and influence it directly on a host of policy issues that are favorable to them. But on the tax side, they really want us to go back to the Middle Ages, when we had peasants pay all the taxes and the landlords and the feudal lords paying nothing. I don't think that's a recipe for a healthy democracy. And the United States was at the forefront of designing and defending a progressive tax system. And the current trends are in the opposite. We're going to end up with middle class and the poor paying all the taxes and the wealthy just taking advantage of globalization to offshore their wealth.
Well, it seems a good point to mention. I had left it out, but the same CNBC analyst who had told us that Trump's tax plan is the farthest thing possible from a plan for the 1%, he had this to offer, and I'll just leave you with this. What's the biggest takeaway from the Paradise Papers leak? America needs tax cuts. Now, you know.
Well, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely false. Historically, we've had 30, 40 years of tax cuts. The corporate tax has been chopped again and again. We've been also on the individual side. We've been engaged in a race to the bottom with other countries around the planet. No major U.S. multinational pays anything like 35% corporate tax rate. You know, Apple's average tax rate is less than 5% because they take advantage of the offshoring that they're already able to do. And, you know, the average effective rate for corporations, including small business in the country, is about 12% right now after all the tax breaks. Furthermore, these companies are the most powerful and most successful in the world. They're at an all-time high in terms of stock market valuation and corporate profits as a share of national income. So it's just ludicrous to propose that the United States somehow is suffering. What we would suffer from would be a gigantic inflated deficit if this tax bill were passed on the order of $2 trillion, which we, you know, I thought the Republicans were opposed to that. But it would be an immediate $800 billion gift to the top 100 companies on the planet that have stashed $2.6 trillion offshore because, you know, the first stage of it would give them a 5 to 10% tax rate on any of that they rebated without conditions. And so that would be a huge payday for them.
We've been speaking with James Henry. He's a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network. James Henry, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're very welcome.
After the Sutherland Springs, Texas mass shooting, media picked up the familiar threads on gun violence and mental health, but some also took up the less commonly explored, though established, connections between mass shootings and domestic violence. And not just whether those with records of domestic violence, as the Texas shooter had, should be able to buy guns, but the bigger problem of how domestic violence is portrayed, you might say dismissed, including by media, as a private problem rather than a societal one. We talked about this last June after the mass murder at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Writer and activist Soraya Chamali directs the Women's Media Center Speech Project and is organizer of the Safety and Free Speech Coalition. She had just written about domestic violence and the Orlando shooting for Rolling Stone.
Well, I'll start where your article starts. I was not, in fact, surprised to learn that the killer in Orlando had a record of domestic violence. Why wasn't I?
Well, I think time and time again, we've seen examples, and we could go through a list, Sandy Hook, the Sydney shootings. I'd forgotten about that, but that had started in domestic violence, the Colorado abortion clinic attack. And so when you see it happen, and it's such a distinct pattern in the course of the violence, you sort of wait for the other shoe to drop. And I think what happens is that most people who maybe aren't attuned to this particular dimension will see items in the news that are fairly poorly framed, are given headlines that don't really address perpetration, but instead identify victims. It's hard to then understand the wider context for this idea that it's violence in homes and tolerance, societal tolerance for violence in homes, that is the necessary precursor to all of this public violence.
Well, connecting dots between coercive and abusive behavior, some of which is considered normal, you know, and lethal violence doesn't mean saying every domestic abuser is a mass murderer in the making, but it's a value in seeing these echoes, right, in terms of telling us all of the points that we need to engage.
That's right. I mean, I think a lot of people hear 57%, I think it's 57% of mass killings start in acts of intimate partner violence or, you know, family violence, whether it's sons killing parents and siblings, or fathers killing entire families, or ex-spouses attacking intimates. They leap from that to hearing instead all domestic abusers are going to be mass killers, which is obviously just kind of a breakdown in logic. But I think that as a society, we're trying to figure out, why is this happening? How can we prevent it from happening? And very clearly, one thing we have to do, otherwise I really do believe efforts will fail, even though clearly, you know, better gun control would reduce the number of gun deaths we have. But clearly, one of the things we have to do is really take a step back introspectively and look at how tolerant we are of violence in homes. Very hands-off about it still.
Right. And of course, you don't want to be framing it as, let's pay attention to men who commit domestic violence because they might go on to do, you know, something else.
That's
the
right.
point is what they're doing now. Well, some people, not enough maybe, but some noted that a week before the killings, conservative Christian leader James Dobson had suggested that men take up arms to defend their wives from trans people
yes.
in bathrooms. He said, if you are a married man with any gumption, surely you will defend your wife's privacy and security. If this had happened 100 years ago, someone might have been shot. Where is today's manhood? Well, there's a line between that and killing queer people in a club, and it doesn't pass through Islam, you know.
Right.
At the same time, Dobson said, Barack Obama is a tyrant. He is determined to change the way males and females relate to one another. And I think that gets at something that you wrote about as well.
What we're looking at here is this clash of some very, very fundamental beliefs about gender roles and gender identity. And there simply are people who, for whatever reasons, psychological, emotional, financial, they really believe in binary gender roles, rigid gender roles, and changes in the culture that destabilize that belief are highly threatening. So that's why public bathrooms are such a flashpoint. I mean, the point is that women and children are much, 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 much more vulnerable in their own homes and in places of worship to sexual assault than anybody is in a public bathroom. I mean, that's just clear factually on the basis of what we know. So the public bathroom flashpoint is more symbolic of the fear that people have about those cultural changes. And in this shooting, you know, we really don't know enough about the man as an individual in terms of sexual shame or sexual practices. But what we do know is that he was extremely abusive to his first wife. He treated her like a piece of property. He held her hostage. He violently assaulted her. And he thought that was his right. And in point of fact, he wasn't really challenged in that ultimately, because while she was removed from the home by her family, the family, for a wide variety of reasons, as families often do, don't want to criminalize the person. And so there ends up being, for lack of a better way of putting it, a kind of hermeneutic void in public understanding, because we are so silent, so shamed by what is happening in homes, that we cannot construct the language or the public policy to make sense of it and to then prevent it.
And with that is an inability to collect data, I heard you say on Democracy Now!, to collect the kind of data that would make it a coherent issue so we could see the scope.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, I remember in 2014, a man came to New York City and killed two police officers, and the media were like, basically, oh, right, and before that, he shot his girlfriend. You know, it was very clearly segregated. It was not of a piece in the story.
No.
You know, it was
like incidental. By the way.
It was like, what happened before he was violent, you know? Stopping
yes.
doing that would be good. Stopping saying that people had no history of violence when they have records of domestic violence. What else would you ask for from media in terms of this issue?
Oh, well, I'd like media to diversify its own management, because as long as we have distinctly not diverse management and ownership of media, we will continue to have these kind of epistemologically skewed understandings of the world. We're not asking the right questions, so we cannot end up with the right headlines or the right counter-narratives. And that connection is, I think, also fairly elusive. I mean, it's hard for media to critique itself, right? I mean, the reason that we don't have a good understanding of domestic violence and sexual violence and the role that those play in persistent misogyny and racism is, frankly, because we don't have a very diverse media. And so people tell stories that tend to reflect their own experiences or that they understand. And as a result of that, we just don't see these stories in dynamic profusion.
Right. And you sometimes wonder why some stories do rise to the surface. The Stanford rapist, for example, you feel grateful for the opportunity to shine a light on certain things. But part of you says, you know, this happens every day, right? You know,
right.
And it, but for media, it's almost as though the everydayness of a problem means it gets less attention. You know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually had just this morning published a piece about why the Stanford story became viral.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? Because it is something that happens absolutely every day. And there are some other really horrific stories that are extremely similar, like the Vanderbilt gang rape case last year that didn't raise any public alarms. And what I think is interesting about the Stanford case is that it brought together the Title IX movement and the Black Lives Matter movement in a very graphic way. I mean, Brock Turner's face really became a graphic symbol of those two issues coming together in their mutual critique of fraternal white male supremacy. And it just happened to be at this moment of time that those two forms of entitlement, which are often exercised in rape, came together.
That was writer-activist Saraya Chamali speaking with Counterspin in June of 2016. In a new Village Voice piece in the wake of the Texas shooting, Chamali cites a landmark four-decade study of 70 countries that found that the most important force in reducing violence against women, more significant than economic wealth or even government representation, was a social commitment to strong, independent feminist movements. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.